The solution. The problem with power, perks, and charisma is not that they never work or never should be used. The problem is that people turn to them too quickly, and there are almost always better methods. For instance, savvy parents and influential leaders use their ability to teach. Explore natural consequences. When you watch people who have been singled out by their bosses, peers, and loved ones as the best at handling crucial confrontations, it should be no surprise to learn that they change people's hearts by changing their minds. Savvy influencers recognize that they could propel people to action by using their leadership authority or offering perks. They also know that within the three domains of self, others, and things, there are other factors that are far better motivators that propel action without the leader pulling strings or making threats. What are these compelling factors? They are the natural consequences associated with any behavior. For example, if you don't manage your diabetes well, you are likely to face amputations later in life. That's a natural consequence. If you fail to follow up on commitments, you create extra stress for your boss, who has to guess what will get done. That's a natural consequence. If you make sarcastic and cutting comments when your spouse isn't feeling amorous, she will withdraw and feel less spontaneous affection for you, despite what your lizard brain is telling you. That's a natural consequence. All our social actions put into play a chain of events that affects anywhere from one person to millions of other people. This sequence of events makes up the consequence bundle. Among these consequences, there is a subset of natural consequences that exist independently of the intervention of an authority figure. These methods require no force, no chutzpah, and no charisma. No parent has to wag a finger. No boss has to write up a disciplinary action. Natural consequences are always present and always serve as a potential source of motivation. Make the invisible visible. When it comes to exploring natural consequences, your primary job is to help others see consequences they aren't seeing or remembering on their own. That happens because many of the outcomes associated with a particular behavior are long-term or occur out of sight. Your job is to help make the invisible visible. Here are 6 methods for doing that. Link to existing values. As you consider all the consequences you could discuss with another person, turn your attention to that person's core values. What does he or she care about the most? This will be your point of greatest leverage. Then help the other person see how his or her values will be better realized through the course you are proposing. If you have created enough safety, you can talk frankly about any value issues. Connect short-term benefits with long-term pain. Show how the short-term enjoyment the person currently is experiencing is inextricably connected to longer-term problems. This is essentially the central task of parenting. If you continue to watch television and don't do your homework, you'll get bad grades, you won't get into a good school, you won't get a good job, you won't make lots of money, and you'll never drive your own Porsche. You might not use these exact words, but this is at least part of the map you're carrying in your head, and the map you'd like your child to share eventually, except maybe the part about the fancy car. This method of clarifying long-term or distant negative consequences is also applied at work dozens of times a day. I'm sure it's a hassle to double-check appointments when you enter them on my calendar, but our current error rate is so high that the assistants of the other vice presidents are calling me to ask for confirmation. I worry that your reputation here is going to be hurt if we can't solve this. Place the focus on long-term benefits. This is the other half of parenting. It's also the single best predictor of lifelong success. If a person can suffer a little now, delaying gratification in order to serve a longer-term goal, life gets better. Think dieting, weightlifting, studying, etc. If you doubt this premise, consider a study conducted over a matter of decades. Researchers put a marshmallow in front of individual children and told them that they would get another one if they didn't eat the first one while the researcher stepped out. As the researchers tracked these children over the years, They found that those who had waited for the researchers to return did far better in life than those who ate the confection right away and in almost every domain. To help people stay the course, take the focus off the short-term challenge by placing it on the long-term benefit. Connect to existing carrots and sticks. This is typically not the best starting place, but eventually you may want to talk about rewards. Help others see how living up to an expectation advances their careers, enhances their influence, puts more money in the bank, or reduces their risks. You've mentioned wanting to be the art director. In my view, you will be much more successful in that position, and more likely to get it, if you have solid working relationships with both the editing staff and the video team. Stay in dialogue. Remember, as you're doing your best to make consequences more visible, stay in dialogue. Keep the information flowing honestly and freely in both directions. Watch for the line between dialogue and threats. There is a fine line between sharing natural consequences and threatening others. Well, in most cases, it's not that fine a line. If your motives are wrong, sharing becomes threatening. If your motive is to punish, or if you're taking pleasure in describing the awful things that will happen if someone's obnoxious behavior continues, you are the problem. Your motive must be to solve the problem in a way that benefits both of you. Anything less than that will provoke silence or violence, not gain willing compliance. The line becomes finer when your motives are right, but the other person mistakes your description of natural consequences for a threat. When you fail to complete your assignments on time, we start giving you less relevant assignments to protect ourselves from failure. Can sound like a personal attack or a job threat. If the other person believes that he or she is in trouble, perhaps because of previous experience with other bosses, your best behavior may seem manipulative regardless of your skill or demeanor. If you notice that others appear nervous, step out of the conversation and restore safety by explaining your positive intentions. Explain that your goal is to solve an important problem. You simply want to share the consequences of what they're doing and then ask them for their view on the matter. When they start hearing natural consequences as threats, you should recognize it as a safety problem, not an insurmountable barrier to dialogue. Listen to others' view of natural consequences. When it comes to other people's roles, you should be listening as they explain their view of the consequences. They may be aware of factors you know little or nothing about. "Yeah, we can do it the way you want, but it'll blow up our lawnmower." Your view of what should be done may change in the process of jointly discussing consequences. In the end, you may be convinced that they shouldn't do what you originally asked. Stop when you reach critical mass. As you help others see consequences they didn't realize existed, explain those consequences only until you reach critical mass. Stop once you believe others will comply. Your job isn't to keep piling on information, it is to share consequences until the other person understands the overall effect and shares your view of what needs to be done. Don't sell past the close. Match methods to circumstances. Let's look at the final element of making a task motivating. It has to do with the circumstances you're facing. Sometimes the person you're talking to is simply unaware of the consequences associated with his or her actions. Sometimes you yourself don't understand why the other person isn't motivated. Or perhaps he or she's partially motivated, but the task just hasn't made it to the top of his or her priority list. Maybe the other person's openly resisting your efforts. Let's learn to match method to circumstance. When you're teaching, the methods for explaining natural consequences we've just examined are easy to apply when we're first informing people about the reason behind a specific action. Employees want to know why they have to produce products and deliver services by using certain methods, particularly if what you're asking isn't going to be easy. What they really want to know is whether it's really worth it. As we suggested earlier, effective problem solvers are teachers, and much of their teaching is about the consequences to varying stakeholders. Here's why it's worth it. They make the invisible visible by whatever means work. They do this to avoid gaps. When you're jointly exploring. This circumstance comes up more often than you might imagine. The other person isn't exactly motivated, and neither of you is quite sure why. Perhaps the other person knows why but isn't saying. In either case, you can't figure out why the other person isn't motivated, and you'll need to examine the motivational role of self, others, and things to determine which ones are making the task undesirable. The idea here is to examine each area with simple questions. Is the job hard to do? Is it repetitive, boring, uncomfortable, and so on? Is that why you don't want to do it? Are others encouraging you not to do it? Finally, is the task at odds with what the other person is getting rewarded for? The goal of exploring consequences is to bring to the surface the issues that make the task undesirable. If it's not immediately clear, this could take some work. Once you're both aware of the factors that are at play, decide if you still want the other person to continue. You may change your mind. If you decide that the task still makes sense, use any combination of the methods we've described for making the consequences visible. When others resist. Let's consider a more challenging case. Individuals are openly resisting your efforts. They really don't want to do the task, they need to be convinced, and you need to be careful not to create resistance. That means you'll need to know how to explain why something has to be done without jumping straight to power or discipline. Now what? This is the discussion people have in mind when they say that those they work and live with are hard to motivate. Others fight me at every turn. Fortunately, the basic principle is the same. Explain natural consequences until the person genuinely agrees to comply. In this case, it's a delicate search. You keep searching for consequences until you find one the other person values. Here are examples. Come on, I have better things to do than get my expense reports in the day I get back. We found that the longer people drag it out, the less accurate their reports are. They often forget small expenses, and it costs them money. Consequences to the employee. I've got a good memory. It also causes trouble for the people in accounting. They have their own deadlines and goals. If we wait too long, it throws them off. Consequences to coworkers. Big deal. Let them suffer once in a while. I'm the one on the road half my life. When you don't get your bills in, we don't bill our clients as quickly. Last year, we figure late billing cost the company over $200,000. Consequences to shareholders. We made $1 billion last year. When you drag out your reports for a couple of weeks, I get a call and I have to track you down and hold these kinds of conversations. It's not how I want to spend my time. Consequences to the boss. I didn't realize I was making more work for you. Sorry. From now on, I'll put a reminder in my electronic calendar and it'll keep me on track. This conversation calls for both patience and skill. The person really doesn't want to do what you're asking, and it takes a genuine consequence search to come up with something that motivates him or her. You have to search because not every consequence matters to everyone. In this example, the employee didn't care about anything until the boss talked about how it was inconveniencing him or her, which, by the way, implies the use of power. When to use discipline. Despite your best efforts, sometimes you still have to start down the path of discipline. Perhaps the other person has done something that requires immediate action. Maybe your son crossed the line from resisting your efforts to being disrespectful and insulting. Maybe you've explained consequences and the other person isn't going to do what you ask, no matter what you say. Perhaps you've had multiple conversations describing content, pattern, and relationship, but the employee is still violating every agreement you make. It's time to change tactics. It's time to move away from natural consequences and start imposing consequences of your own, discipline. As you start down this precarious path, keep the following in mind. Know the mechanics. Every organization has its own discipline steps and policies. Study them carefully. If you fail to follow procedure, your efforts may be thrown out when they are reviewed, undermining your credibility. Families should create their own clear disciplinary steps as well. If they do not, everything comes as a surprise. Partner with people in authority. If you're in a situation in which you don't know the person's total history and details, explain why the action was wrong, state that you're going to move to discipline, and say that you'll get back to him or her later. Then check with specialists to learn what the actual steps should be. Otherwise, you may suggest that you're going to send the person home without pay, and then find out that he or she was only due for a warning. You'll have to eat your words. The home version of this should be obvious. Parents must be unified in their actions. Be appropriately somber. Discipline isn't something you impose with a sense of pleasure, regardless of what the other person may have done. Keep the tone serious and speak about what has to be done, not what you now get to do. This is not a time for a smug, in-your-face celebration. You're moving from partnering to policing, and that's hardly a victory. Explain the next step. As you explain what will happen as a result of the infraction, cover what will happen if the person does the same thing again. Explaining the next level of consequences informs and motivates. It also helps eliminate surprises. Nobody said I was going to be fired! Be consistent. Don't play favorites. If you're working with an employee who gives you fits at every turn, you can't discipline that person for something you wouldn't discipline everyone for, simply as a means of getting even. When discipline falls under review, the first thing third parties examine is equity. Did the person get fair treatment? Don't single people out. Don't back off under pressure. Once you've started the process, stick to it. Follow the steps and don't be dissuaded simply because the person puts up a fight. If discipline is called for, stay the course. If you waffle, you'll gain a reputation for making hollow threats. When power fails, be candid about coping. Let's look at one final issue. What if you've explained the natural consequences associated with an action, but others still aren't motivated, and you can't or shouldn't impose consequences to increase their motivation? Let's say your boss realizes he should stop yelling at you and others, but says the following. I know it's wrong, I know it frustrates people, but I'm high-strung and under a lot of pressure, and it's just going to happen sometimes. Now what? You're not likely to impose consequences on your boss. Or let's say your business partner has been unreliable in getting assignments in on time, and after a lengthy discussion, you still believe it's likely she'll get them in late. What do you do? Agree on a workaround. When you've decided not to administer discipline as a way of compelling someone to change his or her actions, develop a coping strategy and then candidly share it. That way, as the other person observes and experiences the consequences of the workaround, he or she can choose to act differently if he or she wants to avoid the pain, waste, and inefficiency you've talked about. For instance, from this point on, you will not give your unreliable partner critical path assignments. She may not be happy about this choice because she wants to be involved with the hottest assignments. Nevertheless, at least she understands why you're doing what you're doing. With an emotionally explosive boss who refuses to change, you might suggest that when he blows off steam, you'll eventually withdraw, allow time for him to calm down, and then return for a healthier and more complete discussion. You might also share that you are likely to be reluctant to challenge some of his more vigorous arguments. You'll do your best to be candid, but his defensive actions will continue to make that difficult for you. By being candid about your coping strategy, you empower your boss to choose whether he wants this consequence bundle. This point is so important that we want to expand it a bit. For people to behave badly over the long haul, we have to do two things. First, we have to avoid crucial confrontations. By doing that, we avoid helping others see the consequences of their behavior. If we don't alter their expectations, why should they change what they do? Second, we create a workaround that enables others to continue doing what they're doing, unaware and guilt-free. For example, our boss never returns calls, and so we secretly assign someone to do it for her. A doctor is incompetent, and so we discreetly schedule complicated surgeries for when he's off shift. Our dad is grumpy and abusive, and so we buy him his own widescreen TV and build him a den. The reason others aren't motivated to change is often because of us. We're conspirators. Either we misuse power and mobilize others' resistance, or we withhold honest feedback and then take great pains to create clever and secret workarounds that continue to keep others blind to the consequences they're causing. Even if you don't have the power to impose your will on an unwilling person, you can avoid being part of the problem by being candid about your coping strategy. Chapter 5. Make It Easy. How to Make Keeping Commitments Almost Painless. It's time to move to the ability side of our model. We'll start with an example. Kyle, a political analyst who works for you, was supposed to write a position paper for an upcoming debate and have it on your desk by noon, but he didn't. You call him in for a private discussion and describe the gap. He lets you know that he really wanted to do what he promised and says that it wasn't his fault that he didn't. The specialist who conducts the statistical analysis was hospitalized with a burst appendix, and she's the only one who understands the data. In any case, Kyle was prevented from doing what he agreed to do. And then he did exactly the right thing. He immediately called to let you know about the problem, but you were in a meeting across town. He left a message on your voicemail and then tried to track you down. In short, he wasn't able to meet his commitment and did his best to let you know. This was definitely not a motivation problem. Don't misdiagnose. Having just read the last chapter, you decide it would be a good idea to tell Kyle about the natural consequences of missing the deadline. You figure that he needs to know. Let me tell you something. If people ask the wrong questions at the debate, we're going to look like a bunch of dopes because we don't have the position paper. Kyle turns ashen white, mumbles something about tracking down the specialist, and dashes off like a scared rabbit. Now he's really motivated, you think to yourself. We hope you wouldn't actually do this. Being the steely-eyed, smart person you are, you would note that Kyle was motivated to do the job. Piling on more reasons for doing something he wasn't able to do in the first place would be the wrong cure. Indeed, it would be cruel. Kyle needs help removing the barriers he's facing, not a kick in the pants. And so that's where we'll turn. What does it take to help others remove any and all barriers they face? Better still, what can we do to make it easy, even painless, for others to complete their assignments? In the short run, if a task is undesirable but not impossible, we can crank up the pressure and get the job done. Over the long run, we want to find a way to remove some of the factors that make the job undesirable, or we'll constantly be looking for ways to motivate people to do what they hate doing. And that's never fun. Motivation and ability can be confused. Here's another concept to keep in mind. When diagnosing the cause, we have to be dead certain that we haven't confused motivation and ability. As completely different as the two things are, people don't always make it easy for us to tell whether they don't want to do what's been asked or can't do it. In fact, we pretty much assume that if we ask nicely enough, people will tell us straight out whether they couldn't complete an assignment, they wouldn't, or both. Masked cause. Believe it or not, sometimes people purposely hide the genuine source of a problem. If they fear that they'll get in trouble for not being able or not wanting to do what's been asked, they may stretch the truth to avoid new problems. For example, an attending physician asks a medical student to insert an intravenous line into the chest of a 75-year-old patient. The student isn't quite sure how to do it, But when the doctor is called away to work on a cardiac arrest, the student says nothing. Instead, he attempts to insert the line and punctures the sac around the woman's lung, and the patient later dies of related complications. A woman dies because the student is uncomfortable, saying that he just might be unable to do what he's been asked. This actually happened. Probably the most common form of masking takes place when people cover up their lack of motivation with a bogus ability problem. This often occurs when a person figures the boss doesn't really care what happens, but then the boss shows up wanting to know why the job wasn't done. Suddenly, an ability block sounds better than saying, "I didn't make it a priority." Thus, people come up with whoppers like these. "I would have been here for the early meeting, but my alarm didn't go off."
"I would have mowed the yard before your lawn party, but was wondering if maybe I should cut it shorter than usual."
It's important to listen carefully to the answers to your diagnostic questions. When John states, "It's got all those fancy numbers and charts and things, not that I couldn't do if I wanted to," a careful person might continue probing about difficulty, making it safe for John to say that he has trouble with the directions. In responding to bogus motivation problems, it's common to give the person the benefit of the doubt the first time. "So what are you going to do to ensure that your alarm goes off next time?" If excuses keep cropping up, you have to deal with the pattern, as in this example. "This is the third time you've run into some kind of problem. We've been patient, but the fact is, you have to make those early meetings. The last 5 times I asked you to do a chore around the house, you agreed, I left on an errand, and then you came up with questions and didn't do the job." Your job, make it easy. Let's say you've diagnosed the cause and the other person can complete the task, but it's really horrible and tedious. Now what? It's your job to help remove the barrier. It's your job to help make it easy. Unfortunately, not everyone agrees with this. In fact, some people take pride in their ability to inspire others to complete noxious or tedious tasks. In truth, there is no great honor in being a leader or parent who is able to encourage people to continually achieve the nearly impossible. It can be gratifying to be an effective motivator, but the best leaders don't simply inspire people to continue to do the gut-wrenching, mind-boggling, and noxious. They help people find ways to ease the gut-wrenching, simplify the mind-boggling, and nullify the noxious. This is where influence masters truly shine. They see themselves as facilitators, enablers, and supporters, not armed guards or cheerleaders. This self-image may go further in separating the best from the rest than does any skill they actually possess. Skilled problem solvers take pride in helping others make things easy. It's part of their golden rule. It's what they do. Less skilled and more controlling folks have a different view of their role. They get people to do whatever it takes at whatever the cost, and then brag about their leadership prowess. For them, making other people's burdens less burdensome is a sign of weakness. The home version of this attitude isn't any more attractive. For instance, getting your spouse to open up about a sensitive issue by piling on a truckload of guilt and manipulation. Why would anyone ever want to do such a thing? Because it's a power trip, and some people love power more than they love relationships or even results. Believing that it's praiseworthy to be able to compel people to complete tasks that are painful paints an intriguing yet counterintuitive picture of leadership. After all, human beings are forever finding ways to avoid pain and seek pleasure, not the other way around. Distasteful tasks may be good for people at some level, and it's true that employees are generally getting paid to do them, but if they're normal human beings, they're going to try to find a way to get out of dreadful jobs, or at least make them easier. Don't most of us use automatic garage door openers, punch TV remote control buttons, and open cans with a gadget of some kind? We don't need any of these things, but they make life easier. It's important to make this distinction between necessity and convenience,
because we must be comfortable with the idea that it's okay for people to want to find an easier, more convenient way to do a job.
Tools for making it easy. Jointly explore barriers. Knowing what to do with an ability barrier is actually fairly simple. Jointly explore the underlying ability blocks and remove them. That's easy. In contrast, knowing how to remove those barriers requires our attention. That means we need to know if others can't do something because of self, they don't have the skills or knowledge, others, friends, family, or co-workers are withholding information or material, or things, the world around them is structured poorly. But before we consider the ability side of our six-source model, we'll have to break years of bad habits. Avoid quick advice. When we hear that someone faces an ability barrier, we habitually jump in with suggestions. We don't even think about it. We're experienced and we understand how things work, and so when we see a problem, we roll up our sleeves and fix things. It's positively Pavlovian. We see a problem and bing, the gate is up and our tongues are off and running. Involvement both enables and motivates. If you involve others in solving problems, two important things happen. First, you get to hear their ideas. People may not know exactly what to do, but they probably have a good idea about what doesn't work. Actually, they may know exactly what to do, but need materials or permission to do it. In any case, start ability discussions with a simple question. You've been working on the problem. What do you think needs to be done? Ask them for their ideas. Invite them to put their theories, thoughts, and feelings on the table. They'll start to identify the barriers cell by cell. When people aren't completely certain about what to do, or if it becomes clear that they don't understand the situation fully, it's perfectly legitimate to chime in with what you think might help. Of course, how you toss in ideas makes a big difference. Style counts. The feeling of the conversation should be one of partnering. You're working together as intellectual equals, both of you throwing in your thoughts. Motivate. There's an important secondary benefit to involving others. When people are involved in coming up with a potential solution, they're more likely to be motivated to implement it, and that's important. Most problems have multiple solutions. The effectiveness of a solution depends on the accuracy of the chosen tactic. That's obvious. It's equally important that the person implementing the tactic believe in it. That's where commitment comes into play. A solution that is tactically inferior but has the full commitment of those who implement it may be more effective than one that is tactically superior but is resisted by those who have to make it work. Let's be clear about what we're proposing. Many people argue that the reason for involving others is to trick them into thinking the ideas are their own so that they'll work harder to implement them. We're not suggesting that you manipulate people into thinking that your ideas are theirs. Involving others is not a cheap trick. We're simply proposing that other people do have ideas, that getting them out in the open is to everyone's advantage, and that when people are involved in the entire thought process, they see why things need to be done a certain way and are motivated to do it that way. By involving others, you empower them. You provide them with both the means and the motive to overcome problems. Start by asking for ideas. Involving people is better than merely telling people. But how should you do that? This is quite simple. When we first trained people to deal with ability problems, it all seemed so simple. You ask others for their ideas, you get to hear their best thoughts, and they feel empowered. What could be easier? Who could possibly mess this up? As it turns out, there are several ways to go wrong. Here are the top three things not to do. Don't bias the response. As we trained people with these materials over the years, many participants would try to involve the others in resolving an ability problem in the following way. So you haven't been able to get in touch with the lawyers. Here's an idea. Drive over to their office and wait until they return.
What do you think?
People who choose this tactic understand only half of the concept of empowerment. As long as they give the other person a chance to disagree, they feel okay. Unfortunately, when you're speaking from a power base, offering up your idea first and then asking for the other person's approval misses the mark. You're likely to bias the other person. First, you're filling his or her head with your idea, and this can cut off new thinking. Second, you may inadvertently be sending the message that your idea is what you really want, and so others are not about to disagree with you. Don't pretend to involve. This mistake in involving other people in solving an ability barrier is propelled by two forces. First, you already have an idea and would prefer to implement it without involving others. Second, you believe that you now have to involve others because it's the politically correct thing to do. Here's what you come up with. You simply pretend to involve others by asking for their ideas, after which you subtly manipulate them to come around to your way of thinking. As you might suspect, this technique comes off as glaringly manipulative. It looks more like sending a rat through a maze and periodically throwing it a pellet for making the correct turn than like a legitimate effort to involve another human being in removing an ability barrier. Don't feel the need to have all the answers. This mistake is the product of low confidence and a bad idea. Newly appointed leaders are often unwilling to ask their direct reports for their thoughts because these leaders believe that if they don't appear to know everything about the job, they'll look incompetent. In their view, asking for ideas isn't a smart tactic, it's a sign of weakness. When they are facing an employee with an ability problem, the newly appointed do their best to share their insights. The last thing they want to do is query an employee who not only reports to them, but obviously needs help. Of all the bad ideas circulating the grapevine, pretending that leaders must know everything is among the most ridiculous and harmful. Leaders earn their keep not by knowing everything, but by knowing how to bring together the right combination of people, most of whom know a great deal more about certain topics than the leader will ever know, and propel them toward common objectives. Confident leaders are very comfortable saying, "It beats me. Does anyone know the answer to that?" Or, "I don't know, but I can find out." Advise where necessary. Our goal has been to collaborate with the other person in bringing to the surface and resolving ability blocks. We don't want to rush into solutions too quickly or force our ideas onto others. Besides, as we've argued all along, the people closest to a problem are likely to see more barriers than anyone else can. Nevertheless, there are times when people do need help. They can't see the barriers that have them stymied. In this case, it is our job to teach and advise, to point out stumbling blocks. In short, our job is to make invisible barriers more visible. Pop the question. As you finish a crucial confrontation, there's a danger that despite your efforts to bring to the surface all the causes behind an ability problem, you still have unfinished business. The person still isn't motivated. How could that happen? This typically occurs when you describe the problem and the person immediately identifies an ability barrier. People tend to point to ability issues because they're less threatening. Never mind the fact that they also have conflicting priorities. That brings us to our point. The fact that people start by identifying an ability block doesn't guarantee that once it's removed, they'll want to do what they've promised to do. Once you've finished identifying and removing ability barriers, pop the question. Ask, "If I get the work up to you by 2 o'clock, are you willing to do what it takes to finish the job by 5? Or is there something else I need to know?" Popping the question means that you end a discussion of ability by checking for motivation. Of course, it goes both ways. If a person starts with, "Do you really want me to do that? It's such a pain," and you spend time explaining the natural consequences until he or she agrees to comply, there's a chance the person may also be facing an ability barrier or two. Once the person has agreed to comply, pop the question. Check for ability problems. It sounds like you're willing to do this, but is there anything standing in your way? Is there anything else we need to deal with, or can I count on you having this to me by Tuesday at 9? Once you've dealt with motivation, check ability. If you start with ability, check motivation. Remember to pop the question. Make it safe for others to search. Let's end our discussion of ability problems by considering a difficult case. You want to brainstorm root causes with another person, but don't have the authority to do so. For instance, your boss promises to give you a hand with customers during peak hours, but he's routinely unavailable when you need him. Are you really going to have to motivate your boss to live up to his promise? Is that what's going on? One thing is certain, you want to get to the root cause. Does he dislike helping out because he doesn't like working with hostile customers? Does he think the work is beneath him? Are other priorities more important? Has he forgotten how to do the job? You don't know what's actually going on here. Your only goal is to talk to your boss, identify the real forces behind his not helping, and learn if the problem is going to go away or if you're going to have to find a way to live with it. That means you have to encourage your boss to join with you as you jointly brainstorm reasons he isn't doing what he promised to do. Or if you're in a real hurry, you could just step in front of a moving train. Ask for permission. We've talked about this before. If you lack the authority to require another person to discuss root causes, you can do so only by permission. So ask for it. If you do have the authority, ask for it anyway. Since we agree on the problem, could we take a few minutes to talk about what's in the way of solving it? I'd like to be as helpful as I can in making it easy to avoid the problem in the future. Would that be okay? Ask for feedback. Perhaps the most gracious way to open the door to a complete discussion of underlying causes is to ask if you are adding to the problem. When you take responsibility for your contribution, you make it safe for other people to do the same thing. My goal is to solve the problem. I'm particularly interested in learning about anything I might be doing to contribute to the challenges you face. Prime the pump. People often feel unsafe discussing root causes because they fear that any analysis will make them look weak or selfish. If they are not able, that's bad. If they're not motivated, that may look worse. You need to change this view. Your job in leading a root cause discussion is to let others know that you see them as people of worth who are currently unable to do what's expected. This isn't about fixing their character. It's about fixing a problem. One of the best ways to assure others that you're not going to get angry when you learn the root cause is to prime the pump or take your best guess at possible causes without looking stressed, miffed, or judgmental. This helps others start the flow of information by making it safe for them to speak honestly. Priming works only if you take your best guess in a way that tells the other person that you're okay with him or her admitting to what you just described. Word choice, body language, and tone of voice make a huge difference. Consider the following question. Is that too hard for you? Now read the line in a patronizing way. Next, do it in anger. To draw on your real talents, read the line with sarcasm. Finally, try to be respectful. Imagine that this is a person you care about and genuinely want to help. How does that affect your delivery? When it is done well, priming provides others with real-time, visible evidence that you're not going to demean or criticize them for honestly discussing the real issues. In short, your success depends on whether you see other people as human beings or villains. If you've come to see others as people you want to help succeed, most of the time you'll do just fine. Chapter 6. Stay focused and flexible. What to do when others get sidetracked, scream, or sulk. Up to this point, we've created a map showing how to master a crucial confrontation. It describes key principles and skills, not fixed roads laid down on an unmovable terrain. This means that the principles and skills have to be woven into a workable script on the spot as the conversation unfolds. This on-the-spot creativity calls for an enormous amount of flexibility. After we describe the gap, we have to diagnose what's happening. Are people failing to come through because of a motivation problem, or is it ability? Otherwise, we're likely to charge in blindly and apply the wrong prefabricated fix.
I can't believe that you came to our biggest meeting of the year a full 30 minutes late!
Oh, your mom's funeral, huh? That was awkward. It gets worse. Not only do we have to work unrehearsed and on the fly, we have to be flexible enough to deal with new problems as they seem to appear out of nowhere. We're talking about problem X, and problem Y emerges right there on the spot. For instance, you're talking to a coworker about doing his fair share of the workload, and he becomes angry. You're chatting with your daughter about failing to practice the piano, and she lies to you. You're talking to an employee about missing a deadline, and he becomes insubordinate. You're talking to your unemployed husband about actively looking for work, and he tries to divert you from the problem by playing the martyr. Your head accountant clams up when you ask her why the end-of-the-month reports aren't ready. Then she gets angry. All these situations present you with new, emergent problems. We must be focused and flexible. As new problems emerge, we have to be focused enough not to get sidetracked. We can't let every breeze blow us in a different direction. By the same token, we have to be flexible enough to step away from the current issue and deal with the new problems on the spot if necessary. When a brand new problem with a life of its own comes up in the middle of a crucial confrontation, we have to decide. Do we step away from the current problem, putting a bookmark in place so that we can get back to it later, and address the new problem? Or do we stay the course? This takes us back to the issue we addressed in Chapter 1. What is the right crucial confrontation? Now we're introducing the idea that the right confrontation can change before your eyes. The answer to this new if question is simple. If the new emergent problem is more serious, time-sensitive, or emotional than the original one, or if it's important to the other person, you have to deal with it right there on the spot. You can't allow the new and more important issue to be at the mercy of the original problem. For example, you can't have your daughter lying to you. Lying is worse than missing practice. You can't allow an employee to become insubordinate. If you don't say something right away, you undermine your credibility. You can't allow a person to fume and boil and pretend nothing is happening. It'll only get worse. The good news is that if you choose to move to the new and emergent topic, all the skills we've looked at so far are applicable. Of course, if you decide to deal with the new problem, you need to do so in a focused way. Don't be tricked into getting sidetracked, and don't drift aimlessly from topic to topic. Carefully transition when you change your focus. 4 different emergent problems and how to address them. To see how this works, let's look at 4 different categories of new problems. There is a loss of safety. There is a loss of trust. A completely different issue becomes a problem. And explosive emotions take over. Each category requires the same basic skills, but each is different enough that it deserves careful and separate attention. People feel unsafe. This is the most common emergent problem, and we talked about it earlier. You're discussing a failed promise, and the other person becomes frightened and starts to pull away from the discussion or push too hard. Either response brings honest dialogue to a screeching halt. Fear and the resulting silence or violence are the emergent problem. If you don't step out of the existing conversation and establish safety, you're never going to resolve the issue at hand. So that's what you do. You step out, create safety, and step back in. In this case, you don't need to acknowledge a change in topic because you aren't changing topics. You're simply dealing with the real problem, which is not the topic itself, but the fact that the other person feels unsafe discussing it. To restore safety, you point to your shared purpose. You assure the other person that you care about what he or she cares about. You use contrasting to clarify the misunderstanding. You apologize when necessary. You make it safe. If you don't, you'll never be able to resolve the original issue. People violate your trust. This is probably the most dangerous new problem, the number one killer of accountability, and the chief reason most people can't have a crucial confrontation without breaking out in hives. When family members allow one another to break promises and ignore the consequences, pain and suffering are just around the corner. When it comes to child rearing, arbitrary accountability is a big contributor to delinquency and insecurity. Giving family members the luxury of arbitrarily choosing which promises they'll keep, turning life into a cafeteria of commitments in which people can keep one of this one but not one of those, drives people insane. The intersection of flexibility and focus. Let's be realistic. Things do come up. In today's tumultuous world, changes occur all the time, and if you can't make mid-course corrections as new information pours in, your company will die. You have to be strong and flexible. You have to be able to bend but not break. How can you be at once focused and flexible? It's actually easy. At the heart of every workable accountability system, there is one simple sentence. If something comes up, let me know as soon as you can. This sentence represents the marriage of flexibility and focus. In these 12 words, two seemingly contradictory elements form a perfect harmony, the yin and yang of accountability. Although the words are sparse, to speak them is to say, I want you to live up to your promise. Please don't unilaterally break it. I want you to focus on getting the job done. At the same time, I realize that the world can change. Things come up. Many of these barriers will negate your existing promise. If something does come up, let me know as soon as possible so there are no surprises and so we can decide together how to handle the situation. Consider the following situations. Sometimes the thing that comes up will affect motivation. For example, your son is on the way to take a makeup algebra test after school, and his uncle stops him along the route and asks him to go to the movies. He's been lonely since his divorce, and your son thinks he should go along, so he wants to change his priority, but not without talking. Together, you should decide if his uncle really needs the familial support or if he needs to keep his grades up, or maybe you can find a way to do both. Sometimes the thing that comes up will affect ability. For instance, the air conditioning unit breaks down and the production manager thinks she should let everyone go home early even though she promised to finish a project. This may be the right solution, but she should first check with the major stakeholders, in this case her boss, to see if this is the best solution for the situation. Maybe, based on the reasons for the deadline and the costs of missing it, it makes better business sense to pay the service experts overtime plus a surcharge to get the equipment fixed right away. With a policy of, if something comes up, let me know as soon as you can, we should expect pretty immediate communication. Thanks to modern technology, when we say, let's talk as soon as you can, that can be pretty fast. Between email, voicemail, and cell phones, we are always no farther away from each other than the speed of light and the click of a button. To put this in perspective, you can track someone down in China about 100 million times faster than Marco Polo. The foundation of crucial confrontations. Let's return to our friend who told us that he didn't attend the computer class because something came up. What should we say to him? Naturally, the way we approach the failed promise will depend on our own private history of accountability. If in our company promises are merely rough guidelines, include the possibility of a surprise, or are made with a wink, we've reaped what we've sown. There's really not much we can say. In fact, in a huge number of companies, and families are no different, the following is true. Results equal no results plus a good story. In institutions where accountability is shaky, people treat you as if you've succeeded as long as you have a good story. In this inventive culture, failure accompanied by a plausible excuse equals success. and we all know what the good story is. Something came up. It's the catch-all story. It keeps you from ever being held accountable. That is, if friends, family, bosses, and co-workers actually let you get away with it. But you know better. You understand that a crucial confrontation, by definition, deals with failed promises, and if you don't have to keep promises, everything falls apart. You also know that things change, and so if there is a need to change, talk as soon as you can. Therefore, when you first started working with your team, you spoke in great detail about the all-important sentence, "If something comes up, let me know as soon as you can." You explained how these few words, when honored, bring predictability into a turbulent world. You spoke eloquently about how this simple phrase emphasizes the importance of both the need for flexibility and the need for predictability. You talked about how it forms the very foundation of trust. And finally, when you first talked with your direct report about attending the computer class, you ended by reaffirming your stance. You said, "By the way, if something comes up, let me know as soon as you can." And you meant it. Dealing with anger. When other people become angry, there is always the chance that they will become violent. They've stepped over one line. Will they step over the next one? Fortunately, most bosses never face anything close to danger at work, at least not from employees. People go to silence more than they go to violence. They complain to their loved ones. They play the martyr and despise you. They carp and seethe, but they don't explode. Nevertheless, there are exceptions. That's why you must determine how dangerous the situation is. No listening skill or anger reduction technique will overcome a person who is chasing you around the desk with a letter opener. Don't be a hero. If you think you're in danger, leave. Remove yourself from the situation. Take flight, don't fight. Then call the appropriate authorities. In most companies, that's security or human resources. Let your boss know what happened. Don't even think about dealing with the danger yourself. Second, dissipate the emotion. If you're not in danger, go straight to the emotion. Don't deal with the argument per se. If someone came to you strung out on drugs, you wouldn't dream of talking to that person about a work-related problem without first dealing with the chemical influence. It's ludicrous to assume that you can have a rational argument with a person who is under the influence of mood-altering stimuli. Anger creates a similarly inflated and abnormal reaction. Anger-based chemicals are legal, of course, but they prepare the body to spring into action, and that doesn't mean talking politely. Therefore, don't deal with the content of the argument until you've dealt with the emotion. The other person isn't very likely to listen to you, or, for that matter, explain his or her own argument clearly and calmly, until the chemical surge has subsided. Any argument you make won't be heard. Any suggestions you offer are likely to come across as an assault. Stifle your desire to jump into the content of the argument. Instead, dissipate the emotion. But how? What does it take to douse internal fires that have been fueled by unhealthy stories? Common but not good practices. Dealing with anger nose to nose, so to speak, is tremendously hard, so hard that it's almost impossible to find someone who does a good job of it. Here are three things not to do. Don't get hooked. Left to our natural tendencies, most of us respond to anger in kind. We get hooked. We become the very monsters we're facing. But then again, why should we expect anything else? Someone who believes that a core value has been violated becomes angry. He or she hurls that anger in our faces, violating one or more of our core values. We become angry in response. Don't one-up. It's hard to imagine that anyone would treat anger with smug indifference, but it happens. An employee barks, "That's the third time in a row accounting has screwed up my check." The boss strikes back with,
Big deal. When I held your job, I had to walk 6 blocks to pick up my pay. There was a time when I didn't get a red cent for almost 2 months, and that was over Christmas, no less. You've got it easy.
When other people become angry, they want first to talk about and then to resolve their problem, not yours. They certainly don't want to be told that their problem can't compete with your lengthy and impressive history of disappointments and disasters. Don't patronize. Acting holier than thou really doesn't work, as this example shows. One of your direct reports charges into your office and complains,
"What was Larry trying to do in that meeting? He humiliated me in front of everyone."
You come back with,
"Now, now, quit throwing a childish tantrum. If you expect to talk to me, you'll need to act like an adult."
Or you might say,
"I can see you're out of control. Here's a dollar. Go get a cup of coffee and return when you're under control."
Telling people to calm down or grow up throws gas on the flames of violated values. They're already fuming about being mistreated, and then you heap on more abuse. You patronize them. Your tone tells them that you think you're superior, and as if this isn't bad enough, you act as if you're their confidant, giving them helpful advice. Third, explore the other person's path to action. When someone becomes noticeably emotional, we see only the action that comes out at the end of their path. In fact, all we can ever see is anyone's action or behavior. Everything else, feelings, stories, and observations, gets trapped inside. Mirror to encourage. When you're talking to emotionally charged people, you may want to do more than simply ask them to talk. You may want to bring in a bigger gun. Mirroring. Here's how it works. Say Tom, one of your direct reports, sat glumly in a meeting, said nothing, and looked discouraged. Normally, Tom is upbeat and contributes a lot to the conversation. As the meeting ends, you find yourself alone with Tom, and so you start with a simple probe. "Are you feeling okay?" In truth, he's not. He's upset and a little embarrassed. Over the last year, Tom has put on 30 pounds, and people have taken to calling him Big Guy. You started the meeting by praising the Big Guy for his recent accomplishments. Your praise, wrapped in the negative label, hurt Tom's feelings. However, when you ask him, he's reluctant to say anything. After all, you were the boss, and it's sort of embarrassing. So he comes back with,
I'm feeling just fine."
Only he says it in a tone of voice and with a body posture that communicate exactly the opposite. To encourage Tom to open up, you hold a mirror up to him. That is, describe the inconsistency between what he just said and how he just said it.
"You know, the way you said that makes me wonder if you are okay. You seem kind of, I don't know, low energy, maybe a bit glum. Are you sure you're okay?"
What you're trying to do, of course, is make it safe for Tom to talk. By holding up a mirror, you're letting him know that you're concerned and that his brush-off wasn't taken at face value. Once again, you're trying to open up a conversation, not compel Tom to spill his guts. Paraphrase for understanding. Sometimes you catch a break. Say an employee is upset, walks in, and dumps out her entire path to action in one fell swoop.
"Boy, am I miffed. You can be so controlling, it drives me crazy. Yesterday I got another one of your follow-up notes. Do you have to monitor me by the hour? I feel like I'm being babysat."
She has shared her feeling, miffed, her story. "You control me too much because you don't trust me," the violated value, and the fact that her feeling is based on either the note you sent her or your history of sending notes to check on how things are going. With this much information on the table, it's best to check to see if you understand what she said. Paraphrase, that is, put in your own words what you think she stated. But don't parrot. Restating exactly what the other person said can be annoying and often sounds phony. Simply take your best guess at what the person just expressed. You're upset because you think I overmanage you? I'm too controlling and send you too many notes. Is that it? Paraphrasing serves two functions. First, it shows that you are listening and that you care. This alone often calms the other person down enough to allow a rational conversation. Second, it helps you see what you do and don't understand. "No, I don't care about the notes," she says. "It bugs me that you give me more notes than anyone else. Do you really think I'm the least competent person here?" Ah, so it's an issue of equity or respect. Different core values. You think I give you more notes than others, that I don't respect you? Well, yeah. Yesterday you talked to Ken and then let him go without so much as a single follow-up. But with me... Prime to make it safe. Sometimes it takes quite a bit to encourage other people to talk openly. They figure that speaking their minds is a bad idea. If they express their feelings openly, they're likely to get into trouble. You've invited and mirrored, but so far the other person has remained emotionally charged and mute. What next? Our final tool takes us right into the other person's story. We prime. We add words to the conversation, much like putting water in a pump to get it flowing, hoping the other person will do the same thing. We do this by guessing what the other person may be thinking. Are you upset because I did something unfair? I gave the promotion to Margie, and maybe you think that you're more qualified or that I didn't do a good job of making a choice. Is that it? The second half of this skill lies in how you guess the story. You're trying to make it safe for others to share their thoughts. That means you have to express your best guess in a way that says, "Don't worry, I'll be okay with this discussion. I won't become defensive or angry." You do this, of course, by stating the story calmly and matter-of-factly. Fourth, take action. Openly talking about the other person's path puts us in a position to deal calmly with the issues that have surfaced. If we willingly talk about other people's thoughts and feelings without mocking, squelching, or attacking them, they are much more likely to calm down enough to both express their thoughts and listen to ours. Once we've uncovered the story and the action that led to it, we're in a position to deal with the problem itself, and this is what we should do. We're not listening for the sake of listening. Once again, we're learning about how to communicate, in this case, how to listen actively, not as an intellectual exercise, but as a way to get results. Create a safety valve. Before we bring this chapter to a close, let's look at one final issue. You approach your boss with a problem that he is causing, and he immediately becomes aggressive. You silently seethe because you were hoping he would help you resolve the problem, not shoot the messenger. Despite your best efforts to stifle the fuming volcano of hate and loathing that is overtaking your Employee of the Month persona, which just last month won you a free week's dry cleaning at the awards banquet, your boss picks up on your hostile tone and warns you that you're starting to step across the line. You find his remarks duplicitous because his tone is always snippy and insulting, but in a thinly veiled, sarcastic kind of way that he thinks is clever and you think places him in the top five in the pantheon of hypocrites. You're at a crossroads. To paraphrase Woody Allen, one path leads to despair and utter hopelessness, the other to total extinction. You can only pray that you have the wisdom to choose correctly. Actually, you have a third choice. You can step back and buy yourself time. You can and should take a strategic delay. "You know what? I need to think about this in more detail. I'll get back to you later." And with that short comment, you hotfoot it back to your office. This is not a retreat. It's a strategic delay. This is not silence. You plan on returning. Once you're ensconced in the safety of your office, you take a deep breath, regain control of your emotions, think about a new and better strategy for talking about the problem, and return another hour or day. If your emotions are in control but you're having trouble coming up with the right words, take a strategic delay. Think about what you'd like to say privately, safely, and slowly, and then return later. Finally, if your emotions are in control but you're about to lose your temper, also take a strategic delay. Your grandmother was wrong when she counseled you on the eve of your wedding never to go to bed angry. When you're angry, going to bed may be exactly the thing you need to do to dissipate your adrenaline, regain your brain power, and prepare to return to the confrontation.